Welcome to Neurosalience, the OHBM podcast. So, welcome everyone to the OHBM Neurosalience podcast live recording session. Thank you. In this podcast, we interview brain scientists and we discuss their work, as well as the latest advancements and developments and challenges in the field of brain mapping. By we, I almost exclusively mean Peter Bandettini, who I am not. Peter unfortunately can't be at the annual meeting this year due to family commitments, so you have me instead. My name is Alfie Wern. I'm a postdoc at McGill University here in Montreal, and I, for the past year, have been the podcast team lead as part of the communications committee, and I'm the incoming chair-elect. Yes, okay, so this is our second live podcast recording. Last year was the first one we ever did in Glasgow, and the discussion at that one was Peter and a panel discussed the now somewhat notorious reproducible brainwide association studies require thousands of individuals paper, which was published in Nature last year. This paper left a mark on the field, and it led to many sort of often quite impassioned discussions. And many were left wondering what was the state of the field going to be moving forward, what would need to change, if anything. And it led many to sort of rush to defend smaller, more focused studies in human brain mapping. Today, we're taking the discussion slightly more to the opposite end of the scale, although in a related way. Instead of large studies of hundreds or thousands of individuals, what about those which aim to characterize variation in brain activity patterns at the level of the individual? Now, historically, learning from individuals has been extremely productive. In Montreal here, the distinguished Professor Brenda Milner, her studies on patient HM is a frequently cited example of this. Deep characterization of a single case study has led to the dramatically improved understanding of the cognitive neuroscience of memory. The earliest fMRI experiments from the early 90s by Ken Kwong and Nancy Kanwisher showcase very strong, bold responses to visual stimuli, flashing grids or faces, and they showed that in single subjects. But somewhere along the line, we have transitioned to fMRI studies that take a group averaging approach. Now, Evelina Fedorenko, in a recent report, sort of argues that this might have been due to the habits of neuroimagers who are used to working with PET data, where you can't study people repeatedly too much for fear of the ionizing radiation. And so you're limited to taking limited samples from individuals with PET data. But with a group averaging approach, individual brains are typically, you warp them to a common template, you may smooth them, after removal of artifacts of noise and so on, you average the bold signal across many people. And coordination of average activity between brain regions, it defines the functional connectome and to which region or node, to which network they all belong. And with this strategy, you can compare patients to healthy cohorts. But in performing analyses in this way, we are missing information about the idiosyncrasies of individual patterns of brain activity. Studies that contrast two populations tend to ignore considerable heterogeneity within each group. In the words of Larry David from Curb Your Enthusiasm, a good compromise is when both parties are dissatisfied. And in the same vein, an average of two or more brains may represent the brains of precisely no one. So some argue that those individual differences may be critical to improving our understanding of the human brain. But is all variation among individuals meaningful? Do we now all need to deeply phenotype every single one of our participants with 10 hours of resting state or scan time? And what actually are we trying to achieve here anyway? So I'm not going to talk this whole time. We have a panel of experts to discuss this who, given their recent publications, have thought about this quite a lot. So we have Ana Luisa Pino, who is a brain scan postdoctoral fellow at the Diedrichsen Lab and the Music and Neuroscience Lab at Western in Ontario. Ana Luisa has worked on deep phenotyping of the human brain through the individual brain charting project, in which 12 individuals have been deeply characterized with a multitude of imaging contrasts and neuropsychological tests. We have Enrico Amico, who is the SNSF Abizioni Fellow at EPFL and University of Geneva. Enrico has developed the field of brain fingerprinting to characterize new approaches of individual identifiability from functional connectomes. We have Emily Finn, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychological Brain Sciences at Dartmouth College. She has a 2015 paper in Nature Neuroscience, which really established the field, or was really remarkable in the field of brain fingerprinting, showing how individuals can be accurately identified from other people with their just their functional connectivity matrices. And finally, we have Tim Laumann, who is an instructor in psychiatry at WashU, St. Louis. Tim has played a key role in the dense sampling data sets such as My Connectome Project, Midnight Scan Club, so repeated scanning and longitudinal monitoring of individuals. So thank you all very much for being here. I'm very honored to have you all on the panel. Thank you for agreeing to this. So that's enough for me, really. I wanted to start off, first of all, I've given you this very brief introduction, but I think it's better to come from your mouths, really. So for each of you has experience with this topic of individual differences, but you've taken slightly different approaches to it, and I think you all have different perspectives on what it actually means to measure individual differences. So if, first of all, we could just go to each of you and ask, what does it actually mean to you to measure individual differences, and what work have you done to characterize this? Ana Luisa, if we could go to you first.
Hello. Thank you very much for the invitation to be here. So individual differences, it really depends on your research question at the beginning. So from the cognitive neuroscience and the functional imaging point of view, I think that having individual variability in your study can be either desirable or not. So if, for instance, if you want to access the profile of your neurocorrelates with respect to a specific psychometric or behavioral measure, it's really desirable to have individual variability. However, if you want to attain some generalization of cognitive processes at the population level, you really want the other way around. You want to mitigate this individual variability. And that's actually the point that I have been mostly focused in my past research. And with respect to that, I can probably point out two main aspects. One is a more empirical aspect related to design efficiency of behavioral paradigms, and also selection of the population that it's the target population of your study, and then the neuroimaging perspective, which is probably more the interest of the crowd here at OHPM. So starting from the first one, I would say that in terms of design efficiency, I would probably state that a way to go is to choose behavioral paradigms that rely as little as possible in overt responses. Because when we introduce overt responses, we are introducing somehow some level of idiosyncrasies related to either task implementation and some procedural details on the performance of the task by the participants. And for instance, a good example of a type of a task that doesn't very much rely on overt responses is naturalistic stimuli. And in naturalistic stimuli, it's also quite beneficial not only to study low level cognitive mechanisms, but also high level cognitive mechanisms. And then we have the imaging point of view. So we have like this family of functional alignment techniques that basically rely on projection of subjects in a common space related to how voxels respond to specific stimuli. So we have the all hyper alignment techniques developed by XB, and also the Cheng, the shared response model developed by Cheng and colleagues. And actually, in individual brain charting dataset, we have been studying this approach. So if you are more interested to know about this, you can drop my poster. And all of these family of techniques have demonstrated to improve subject classification accuracy. Then there's also another aspect that actually benefits a lot from deep behavioral phenotyping techniques, which is we can actually study the stability of specific cognitive networks within sessions, across sessions within specific within subjects, and understand what are the function the networks that are more stable or not.
Okay, so there's lots of things there I want to come back to. You've got hyperalignment, you've got these differences between dual regression and Bayesian spatial, like for functional mapping of networks. So yes, we're going to come back to all of that as much as possible. First of all, Enrico, if you could tell us a little bit about your work in this field.
Hello, thanks for the invitation, thanks for being here. I got intrigued by this concept of individual differences when I started to look at this concept of the functional connectomes, which is a matrix, is a map of the connections between brain region pairs, and is essentially a bunch of Pearson correlation numbers, usually ranging between -1 and 1. And yet, as Emily showed in her seminal paper, you could identify people just looking at this map of brain connections. So the analogy that I usually use to remember this in my head is, if you have this matrix, you can think of this functional matrix as a functional QR code. So every one of us has a specific conformation of white spaces and black lines going all around the brain. And this kind of conformation is somewhat unique. There's some shared variance, of course, but there is some unique conformation related to our functional brain. And what I usually do in my research, since I started in this line of work, is trying to break our functional QR code. So what are the factors contributing to creating this functional QR code? Is it motion? Is it artifacts, purely artifacts? Is it related to preprocessing? Is it related to the neuroimaging modality that you're using? Or is related to brain dynamics, the actual brain network dynamics that is somehow shaping this kind of conformation. And just to give you an example, I'm not going to take all the time on that, but in a recent work done with Dimitri Van de Ville and colleagues, we started to explore the temporality. I really wanted to break the QR code. So we thought, well, how many time points do we need to actually make this QR code appear or disappear? How long do people have to stay in the scanner to have their own unique functional signature? Do they have to stay 5 seconds, 10 seconds, 10 minutes, 2 hours? And so we started exploring the temporality of these in human connectome project data, so healthy subjects. And we found a couple of interesting things. The first one is that you don't need to stay 2 hours to have a somewhat reliable QR code. 2, 3 minutes to 5 minutes is enough for human connectome project data, so high quality, high standard data, of course. But then what was even more interesting was that using an approach that is pretty common in network neuroscience, which is called sliding window connectivity approach, so you're essentially taking a window from your acquisition of points, you're computing the connectome there, and then you slide the window and compute several. It's like you're taking different snapshots of the process as you go through the acquisition. And we try to do identification on these individual snapshots, and the time scale of the process was the window that we were using. So we were throwing a certain number of points, we were creating the connectome, then we were doing this again with a slightly larger window. So we were putting more points into the game, and we were keeping going to go there and to explore the time scale of the process. So we wanted to break the QR code, so we were putting a ridiculously low number of points so that you cannot see anything. And then we were starting to increase the window length to see when the QR code started to appear, when you started to have some sort of identification in a way. And we were also exploring the contribution of different brain regions to that. The interesting thing that we found was that a very short time scale, so to speak, so when you throw not too many points into the game, the regions that are eliciting an individualized response are related to sensory, somatosensory areas and subcortical regions. And then, as you increase the number of time points, you start having regions that are commonly individualized that have been shown by a team, by Emily and many other people. So frontal regions and DMN. So after a certain extent of time points, you start having also the strong individualized response by DMN and frontoparietal. And this was intriguing to us because it was kind of a hint that there is a temporally fluctuating features of fingerprint that is related to the brain network dynamics, to the information content. So this long range, slow range information contact that you can pick up with this analysis. And then what we did, we had this brain map of the time scale of fingerprinting. So you see, we had this like very fast scale gradient that will go from subcortical region to some of the sensory areas. And then we will develop towards more higher order cortices like frontoparietal and DMN. And we matched the brain render that we had with the Neurosynth database to see whether there was any relationship with behavioral score, meta-analytical relationship with behavioral scores. And we found that indeed, short time scales were related mostly to multisensory processing, as we expected. And then it will go towards more higher order cognitive function. This was kind of, I mean, I don't have everything figured out, of course, but that was kind of, let's say, a point in favor on the fact that the QR code that we have is not just only related to, there are many factors contributing to the individual functional QR code. And one might be also the temporality of the process. The fact that brain dynamics, the functional connective in the end is a strong summary of the complex brain dynamics arising between interconnected regions. And somehow, I still don't know why, I don't know how, but somehow this QR code is able to be sensitive on this aspect. Then there are also many other factors related to it that even hand motion can be apparent. Like if you move your head in the scanner in a specific way, you're gonna have a fingerprint, right? I mean it's reasonable. So in the end, probably I just want to close my first part of discussion saying, just be careful on the fingerprinting bit. Not everything is related to behavior. Not everything is related to meaningful things that we are really interested in. There might be many other aspects that you should be aware of before getting deeper into the individual difference game. But yeah, essentially, just circling back to the why I got intrigued to it. I got intrigued because I'm really fascinated by the fact that a very simple object, for me as a network neuroscience, quite trivial object like a Pearson correlation functional connectome can carry this amount of information. And I just try to break it in all possible ways and try to extend in all possible ways. And I'll probably talk about how I break the QR code later.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and it also related to that. So, Emily, I know you've done an awful lot of work on fingerprinting. Maybe in your part, maybe you can also respond to some of that. You know, what is the important? Is all the information that comes out of the fingerprint important? Enrico seems to suggest that actually it's not, and there are many elements of that. So maybe you can tell us. Maybe take a step back as well. Just give us a little bit of context of brain fingerprinting for those who don't know. But then, yeah, some of the more recent work you've been doing.
Sure, yeah, thanks for the invitation. I didn't enter grad school like aiming to study individual differences. I guess the secret history of the fingerprinting project is that we were really interested in Todd Constable's lab at the time in dynamic functional connectivity, as Enrico introduced. So taking these sort of sliding window approaches to understand how the brain reconfigures between different task states. And we were using data from the Human Connectome Project, which most people are probably familiar with, but it had resting state scans as well as several different tasks. So motor task, a social task, and motion task, so on and so forth. We were working with an early release of that data set. So there were, I think, 126 subjects at that point doing all of these different tasks as well as rest. And so what we did was we took this sliding window approach where we were calculating these whole brain connectivity matrices from different subjects as they were engaged in different tasks. And we sort of threw them all into this big clustering algorithm with the idea of, can we cluster different task states based on the functional connectomes during those states? And what we kept on getting out, instead of the connectomes clustering by task, they were clustering by subject. So even the same person at rest versus doing a working memory task versus doing a simple finger tapping task. You know, those were our clusters. It was people, not tasks. And it was the kind of thing where, you know, the data are sort of staring you in the face, and we were like, okay, well, maybe that's our effect. And, you know, so let's start to explore this further. And yeah, I guess just to very briefly introduce the idea of brain fingerprinting, it's this idea that you can sort of carve the brain up into multiple functional units and then calculate a big correlation matrix using the signal time courses from each pair of regions to construct basically just a simple correlation matrix telling you how different pairs of regions tend to co-fluctuate in their activity over time in different brain states. And so those were the fingerprints, so to speak. So those were the things that we could use to match the same individual scanned on two different days or even in two different brain states. The effects were quite large, so accuracy was quite high. Why that's the case is really sort of the meat of the question. So what are the interesting factors contributing to that? What are perhaps the more noisy factors? Although, as I like to say, one person's noise is another person's signal. So, you know, just sort of understanding where that variation comes from is really, that's the meat of the thing. But this observation that people, that there is a fair amount of stability within the same person as well as uniqueness across people in those functional connectivity matrices was really sort of the core of that initial observation that we made. However, even though the same person is identifiable for the most part across different brain states, that doesn't mean that the functional connectome doesn't change with task, right? And so even as part of that first paper, we saw that different pairs of brain states made people sort of more or less identifiable. And so that's kind of the direction that I started moving in. So I was really interested in how different tasks that we can impose on people, different states we can put them in the scanner, how that can sort of either diminish or enhance the uniqueness of these functional connectivity profiles. And not only uniqueness sort of for its own sake, but also uniqueness in the sense that we want at least something in this pattern of connections to be meaningful in the sense that it relates to behavior, right? So I also like the metaphor of sort of a QR code or a barcode, but I think where it breaks down a little bit is that, you know, for a QR code or a barcode, there's each item, let's say, or each website gets a unique identifier, but there's nothing actually in that pattern of black and white areas that tells you anything meaningful. You know, it's just sort of a pointer, it's an index, but there's nothing. You couldn't actually look at the pattern of black and white squares in the QR code and deduce something about the website it's going to take you to, right? And so that's not the case, or at least we hope it's not the case for the functional connectivity matrices. We want there to be some meaning in those patterns, some systematicity where, you know, we can pick up on interesting patterns that not only identify people in the sense of discriminate them from one another, but also predict something interesting about their behavior. And that's true, you know, on a sort of trait level across people, but also perhaps within subject fluctuations in their connectome, how that relates to within subject changes in behavior or development and so on and so forth. So yeah, a lot of the work that I've been doing since that early paper has been exploring other brain states that may even enhance our ability to detect these fingerprints, but even more so to predict behavior, to understand sort of why, like what are the consequences of this functional variation for variation in behavior.
Awesome. Yeah, so again, I want to come back to a couple of things there. One message from that really is how I like that you got into it because you followed the data, right? And you're like, okay, this is interesting. This seems to be a good question. Let's go that way. So you don't, you know, just have, if you've got your ideas and you just want to follow those, but the path seems to be going a different way. I think that's just a good message generally. And how, the usefulness of these is an important question. We're going to come back to that, but I always like to think of it like a real fingerprint, right? You know, it may be unique, but actually what does that tell you about behavior? It doesn't tell you anything, but hopefully these brain fingerprints are a bit more useful. Awesome. So Tim, come to you finally. Yeah, if you could tell us a little bit about how you approach this and what work have you done in this area?
First, thanks, Alfie, for inviting me to come talk, and nice to meet all of you guys for the first time. Thank you all for coming. I guess I might have a sort of different way that I came into this, a kind of different reason that this all came to me, and maybe I'll explain a little bit like how it happened that I got involved in this. And I guess I think it's related to what I think of the superpower of imaging, neuroimaging is, which is localization. like where things are in space, and I suppose also in time. And you know, that's what we're doing with human brain mapping. And so that's what I was into at this time. I was trying to understand brain parcellation. How do we define cortical areas? What is the topography of the network organization? And the lab I was in with Steve Peterson, we had been doing a lot of work on this, and it, you know, we were trying to make sense of these cortical areas and coming up with techniques to define them using functional data, functional connectivity data in particular. And you know, it always come up about, you know, how do we define these well and consistently. And it, at the time, we were involved also in the Human Connectome Project, and this was a serendipitous thing. It happened that Russ Poldrack was on the external advisory panel for the Connectome Project, and so I happened to meet him, and he was discussing this data collection that he was going to do, which was this, with great foresight, this huge data set he was going to collect over 14 months. He was only partway into that when we had discussed it with him. We thought this would be an amazing data set to try to understand, you know, how much data we need to establish aerial parcellations using the techniques that we were working on. And you know, the brain mapping problem is really interesting because it's not like typical mapping in that, you know, like map of the Earth, there's only one Earth, but there are 8 billion people, and so we have to make a map that actually reflects each individual in a way. And so, but to speak with each other and have a common reference and a common frame of discussion, we come up with all these strategies to align things together, and so we can communicate with each other. But that always comes with the compromise, is that if we're looking at any given person, we're going to be in tension with whatever that common reference is, because it's not going to apply exactly to your person. And you know, the example you gave at the beginning, Brendan Milner's work on HM, like that was always at top of mind for thinking about that, and Nancy Kenwisher's work too. When I grokked this, I wasn't sort of thinking about all that. So obviously was, finally we get all Russ's data, and I'm trying to do parcellation, and we had a sort of standard, I had like a template in my mind. What does it look like? I already knew, you know, people in the lab had done work. These are the networks. These are the, you know, the systems we think we're going to see, and we have these ways of looking at the maps and seeing the connectivity map, and it's got a characteristic pattern. And I'm looking in Russ's data and sort of marching along the brain. That's with the area parcellation, the strategy is you're looking at change for changes. And, you know, I remember it vividly. It was like medial prefrontal cortex, there was a spot, and the map that I saw on Russ was just completely different than what I expected. It was, and I was like, this doesn't make any sense. And I think Steve yelled at me about it, and we argued about it, and he's like, what are you doing? You know, it's all this methods or something. And, but because of the data set that Russ had collected at that point, which was over 800 minutes of data, we couldn't like hide behind, well, we haven't sampled this correctly. We don't know. It was there every time you looked. And so we had to, it was just clear, oh, we're missing something here. This other way that we had been collecting and describing these systems was not getting the true picture of what any person actually looked like. And so that was when it was like, okay, we have to turn everything around, the way that we collect the data, the way that we approach it, the way we make sense of it. This, you know, maybe it's going back to the old way. And in the middle, we had a, you know, we got convinced that there was that we had to do it a certain way. But it then opened up this possibility of, well, the brain mapping we've done so far is actually, it's not right, and it's incomplete. You know, we are not at the end of figuring out the neuroanatomy of, certainly functional neuroanatomy of the brain. And so we did the My Connectome project and showed these kinds of observations, and then it was part of that, actually, it was needing to, you know, we had the one subject, and we needed one other one, and actually the first MSC subject, Midnight Scan Club subject, so to speak, which was with Nico Dosenbach and Steve Nelson and Adrian Gilmore and others. We conceived of this, well, we showed it in this one person. Is this just, you know, is Russ just a weirdo? You know, are there something wrong with him? Is this something we see in everybody? And so we actually had there was a second person, it was Nico, in that first paper, and that was the first Midnight Scam Club subject, where we wanted to now replicate kind of what Russ had done and see, okay, can we see this across a lot of people? And it was called the Midnight Scan Club. For those who don't know, it's for monetary reasons, which was that the scanning costs, you know, $600 for an hour, but after 11, it was $50. So we could get for the same amount of data, because we wanted to get these huge amounts of data, we could just bring people in at night, and then we can scan them repeatedly over and over and over and get all the data we wanted. That's why it was the Midnight Scan Club. It was a way of also motivating people, you know, because grad students, so they're only people who are going to be awake at, you know, at those hours and willing to participate in something like this. And so what became clear getting that data set is that this was not unique to Russ. This is something that every person has these, you know, if the Earth had continents and countries, the boundaries are different in each individual. And that's not a problem we deal with outside of the political realm, I guess, in the Earth. But in the humans, it's different for every person. And that was just clear from that data. And what we found is as we looked more and more at those details, at like what were the things that we had not been describing accurately before, it revealed all of these observations that we were underrepresenting and actually misunderstanding some aspects of brain organization completely. And that, I think that project is, you know, it's carried on for basically 10 years since then. It's repeatedly, the more you look at this, if you get these kinds of data sets, you will see different things than maybe what we thought we knew. And, you know, there are other ways in which those kinds of data sets are really valuable, because they lead to, you know, the within subject kind of analyses, looking at state changes, looking at interventions where you're actually looking at the person and themselves over time. And so that whole, the paradigm shift, I think, is it applies in all these different ways that allows us to actually continue the project of brain mapping. In maybe the way that it's always been done, but I think because of the constraints of imaging and the incentives and the way it was set up, it was hard to do it this way. And so hopefully more and more folks will try to do it this other way now, because I think it's the way to do it.
Awesome. Thank you, Tim. So, you know, just to maybe take a step back and just very broadly, I think you touched on it quite a bit there, but I think the ultimate question is, why is this important, right? You've all done lots of work on this and you've all taken these different approaches and thought about it deeply. But, you know, like what benefits is looking at brains on the individual level going to afford us? You know, surely if, you know, playing devil's advocate here, if our goal is to find patterns in a study sample that applies to the general population, you know, why does it matter? You know, why does it matter what that individual looks like? What are the main benefits that we're going to get from studies like this for everyone? Really, this is broadly.
I guess I can take a crack at that. I think for me, there's always been kind of two main motivations why it's important to look at individual differences. The first is more of a basic science one. So, in the sense, as Tim mentioned, you know, I think a lot of the sort of dogma, the way that fMRI was done kind of shortly after its early history and kind of into the 2000s and early 2010s, you know, the received wisdom was fMRI data are noisy, which is true, and therefore we need to aggregate the data somehow to kind of be left with some sort of signal above the noise. And traditionally, the way people did that was by averaging data across individuals, right? That's fine. And I think there are a lot of commonalities across people. And so understanding something generally about how the brain works, the general blueprint of the brain is laid out, is valuable. But at the same time, you know, there's no such thing as an average brain doing these cognitive tasks, you know, these amazingly sophisticated things that we can do with our brains. And so I think looking within individual brains at function under different conditions, if we can sort of map the a cognitive process, let's say, or you know, some kind of thing that we're actually implementing with our brains, it's those things are happening within the level of individuals, right? So I think it's important to get a more sort of rigorous and nuanced understanding of cognition itself if we can actually, you know, map those elements to processes within an individual brain as it's engaging in this behavior. That's sort of, you know, that's ultimately what we want to get to. Because we know that's actually where it's occurring. It's not occurring in this sort of mythical average brain, right? So I think there are sort of, yeah, basic cognitive neuroscience reasons to care about individual differences. And then, of course, there are potential practical applications that I want to be careful. And, you know, I don't think, I think we still have a long way to go before these will be possible. But I think a lot of the goal behind the work that many of us are doing is that we hope that one day it will be relevant to some sort of real world clinical, perhaps educational or other sort of situation where we want to be able to use brain imaging as a tool to understand, you know, who is most at risk for developing a psychiatric or a neurological disorder and have that be sort of another piece of the puzzle for identifying people, treating them. And, you know, we know that there is rich individual variability in who becomes ill and when and how and why. And so from a clinical standpoint, you know, it doesn't make sense to have someone walk into a clinic and have to average their data with a bunch of other people. You know, you want to be able to develop markers that are sensitive enough at the individual level to be able to have a meaningful impact on some sort of real-world situation. So I think that's the practical kind of ultimate goal that hopefully we'll get to at some point.
I 100% agree with all that, and certainly the myth of the group average brain is still holds strong. The other example that I think is very instructive, again, going to patient HM, which was brought up to begin with, and this was a motive for us certainly very early on, is thinking about unique or rare individuals. Often a lot of the insights that we've learned from neuroscience have come from very special cases. It's, you know, there is getting an understanding of what's generally common across all people, but it's actually difficult sometimes to discover what are the basic mechanisms in brains without deep dives on individuals. And so as an example of that, you know, a study we ended up doing much later after collecting the data, and it was clear that getting these huge data sets was really the only way we could do this kind of study. Is there's not going to be a reference for certain people. In the case I'm thinking of, we had an individual who had perinatal strokes and had lost a third of his brain on both sides of both hemispheres. But nobody knew until he was 13 years old, because he was going around the world and was fine, been in school and all of this, and it was much later, and it was until somebody did an imaging of his brain, and oh my God, you're missing a third of your brain. And so how would we study this person? How can we make sense of this person from a reference? There's no way to do it, really. I mean, you use it, but in order to study the individual, we have to get a really accurate picture of what we think is going on in this particular person. And that demands getting as much data as we could on this kid, and that revealed things about, okay, how is the remapping happening in this person to make them still a functional individual despite missing all of this cortex, and so that was a huge insight just from the one person, that it was possible to do this, and it immediately, just that one observation, changed the way you might think about how these networks operate and how they're developed and what's important, what's not important. You know, it doesn't matter that you have this tissue adjacent to this tissue, maybe much less than you think. And so those unique individuals, this was really the only way to study those people. So just to add on as a kind of totally separate practical utility.
I think you highlight an interesting point where actually, you know, there are maybe different disorders may also benefit from this to varying degrees. You know, a lot of my work is with Alzheimer's disease, which varies a lot among individuals, but there is still a sort of sequence of events that occurs, whereas in something like traumatic brain injury or certain strokes, you may have much less commonly classified patterns of atrophy or damage, and then you really need to know how is it affecting this person, right? And you can't, I mean, I have less expertise in this, but maybe it's more difficult to average patients who have had a head injury than it is to average people who have a certain disease that follows a pattern.
Yeah, totally agree with you. But actually, back in the day, because I've been working also with some challenging data when I started my PhD with disorders of consciousness data, so people in vegetative states, minimally conscious state, and I remember that at the time we were doing group averages of things because we didn't know that we were losing meaningful information even from individual patient information, and you know how challenging clinical data are. But this is just, I want to, you know, touch upon again on the clinical fingerprinting bit, because it's, to me, is the simple answer to why do we need this, right? Of course, as Emily said, there's a long way to go, but there are some practical things that we can start working on already with our functional connectome, knowing that there are individual differences from our QR codes. And by the way, I love the origin stories of you guys, Tim and Emily, on, you know, how the papers were created. Because, I mean, I think it's what happens to all of us, right? We just start with one clear idea, and then the data just tell us different story, maybe even more exciting, but you always go off a different tangent most of the time, at least in my work. And yeah, so the clinical fingerprinting bit is something that I've also been working on with the great collaborators and friends. I think Sara Stampacchia was in the room and other people. And I mean, there are two ways you can approach this. One is, imagine that you have like longitudinal data. You are talking about Alzheimer's disease. Imagine that you can track the different scans of a person that then develops dementia, so towards mild cognitive impairment and dementia. It would be the great framework to actually test what happens to the functional connectivity profile as it moves along, how the individual differences are going to be affected by that, the individual connectivity profile. And then the ultimate goal, of course, it's an ultimate goal, will be to associate this transition to clinical score that are taken at the patient bedside, you know, eventually for prediction, or, you know, people are talking a lot about precision medicine these days, individualized treatments. So this would be the direction that we're moving towards. Another option is also to use the connectome as a distance matrix. So how, if I'm a patient, any kind of patient, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, stroke patient, how distant I am in terms of my individual features with a standardized healthy group of reference. So this is like kind of tweaking or extending, relaxing, if you will, the concept of fingerprinting, but can also be useful if you really want to know how far you are going into the neurodegeneration in terms of functional connectivity pattern. And then, we also have a project, you mentioned stroke. I have an ongoing project with longitudinal data in stroke patients, which is also, as you pointed out, it's pretty striking how the brain reconfigures after a stroke. And it's not as trivial as it seems, you know, because many things happen after 1 month, 6 months after a stroke. And it's a very simple concept, but you can be creative in so many different ways. And also, if you are not really into fMRI, which, I mean, it's a safe space here, just so you know, fingerprinting works also if you use MEG or EEG data. So if you want to play with this concept of functional connectivity profiles, individual functional connectivity profiles, you can use EEG or MEG independently. Another thing that I'm also excited and relates to Emily's idea of, okay, let's manipulate cognitive states and see how the individual profile changes. I've been working with drug-induced states. So what happens when you inject a drug into the brain system, like psilocybin or psychedelics, magic mushrooms, or MDMA, or you name it. And this is done with collaborators in the Netherlands, of course, for obvious reasons. And then what happens to the individual QR code? So is it going to be higher, stronger, weaker? And this is like an area that that we started working on. We kind of termed like pharmacological fingerprinting. Can you fingerprint the drug you took? Which can be kind of a scary scenario, like a Black Mirror-esque scenario. But I think we're still early for that. But yeah, I mean, just a couple of ideas for you to think about if you want to keep exploring this concept further. Yeah, I mean, to me, the main point is really how can we take this further? Because eventually, you know, you can identify people even with a structural connectome or a T1 image. I think you can identify people 100%, right? I mean, so in my case, it was never the point of reaching 100% identification. It was, why do we have this in functional brain data? Like, why is this happening?
I don't know. I shouldn't make predictions about anything, but the, thinking about how this stuff will apply in the clinical context, I think I'm very still hopeful about the possibility of if we kind of give it the best college effort we can to get as much data as we can and see can we actually see different things about individuals with various neuropsychiatric issues. You know, that'll be great and come up with new models of things. But I think probably where these kinds of things will sooner come to fruition, and to some extent already have, is with this localization.
Right.
That allows us, if we're using functional imaging, it turns out that structural imaging does not get us to localizing what's going on, what's wrong with a lot of different things. I mean, in certain kinds of issues, strokes and tumors and other neurological issues in particular, that might be very revealing, but we know that it actually doesn't tell us the whole story. And so I think the possibility of using individualized, accurate localization for saying this is the part of the brain that we need to do something to intervene on is going to be the soonest application of this. And it's already, you know, people are using this kind of thing for transcranial magnetic stimulation. I think it would be relevant for thinking about deep brain stimulation. And because it turns out the function actually is revealing a different dimension of organization than what the structure is telling us. It's not enough to have the structure. And that's, you know, from the beginning, I think, was a real interest. I mean, one of the early things we did was doing, I guess it was called a machine, you know, an MLP, a multilayer perceptron, excuse me. And that was to do pre-surgical planning. And it was trying to identify where are the boundaries of different functional systems so that when the neurosurgeon goes in and makes a decision, well, you know, that maybe they're removing a tumor, but the key thing is you don't want to knock out somebody's ability to use their hand or to talk. And we had these very really primitive approaches to actually figuring out whether that was going to happen historically. And task fMRI was being used in this way too, but of course a lot of people can't, especially if they're impaired by like a tumor, may not be actually able to perform certain things. And so that was a real application early on, being able to take functional connectivity data and say, okay, where do we think the boundary most likely is for motor cortex or eloquent cortex, and let's not cut that part out when we do the surgery. And that has already, you know, had, you know, real world applications, for a while now. And I think it'll apply to these other situations just as much.
So then, you know, you say that with this, with the structural imaging, maybe that's not enough, but do you think, to what extent do you think some more advanced, more detailed structural imaging might take you a step closer with just structural imaging? So for example, you know, if you do higher resolution cortical myelin mapping or something like that, you know, maybe do those boundaries align better with the individual functional boundaries that you see? And so maybe we just need different types of data in order. So this, okay, I guess this comes back to the alignment problem, right? Where at the moment we align brains just based on macrostructural, like sulcal patterns and things like that. And when you squish brains like that, clearly that's not enough detail. But if we incorporate other modalities, either a functional connective information or just information about myelin mapping or certain gradients along the cortex, would that help? Using different data to align the brains?
Absolutely. And, you know, we saw the cool lecture from Hong Kui on Saturday that was, you know, there's all these other sources of really detailed, you know, gene expression that might help us differentiate different parts of the brain that might relate more directly to what we're seeing as a function. So it's conceivable, though I guess point out on the parcellation front, what's really interesting, for instance, is, you know, the architectonics along, say, primary motor cortex, you know, there's certain circuitry that's fairly stereotyped, but the functional parcellation divides it orthogonally. You know, the Brodmann area is, you know, from along the sulcus and you know, BA1, 2, 4. But if you look at foot, hand, mouth, it's ventral to dorsal. It's completely the other way. So you can have a similar structural architectonic or circuit, and the representation of function is completely different. So there may be something that, you know, some flag of that at the level of the cell, maybe, that might get us there. But I don't think we're anywhere near that in the technologies so far, certainly in living people. And the cerebellum is another perfect example of that. You know, very consistent cortical circuitry, similarly hippocampus. And yet there are clear functional divides that we can see that completely, you wouldn't say this is where I should draw the line by looking at the structure.
So then going forward, maybe thinking about what sort of data that we should collect in order to characterize these individual differences, all of you really see as the important things that people should do in order so that we can all characterize this within our data sets. I know, Ana Luisa, you have done with the individual brain charting project, there are so many different neuropsychological tasks, but also lots of different contrasts that you're collecting. Do you have any sense of maybe which elements of that are going to be most important, or is the most important thing to collect a broad array of contrasts that characterize the brain in as many different ways as possible?
Yes, so definitely I think that there are no privileged psychological domain. I think that the main approach is really try to go through a wide spectrum of psychological domains, but always taking into account some level of overlap between these psychological domains, so that then we can, for instance, employ some decompositional methods and try to access what are the inner functional signatures that are common to all of these tasks that cover like broader psychological domains. So this is basically relies on the idea that we have tasks that have some level of complexity and involve many different cognitive processes, and they all interplay with each other. There's of course some level of interaction, but we can somehow decompose these complex cognitive processes into more elementary cognitive processes and have the corresponding functional signatures of those. And I would say that in terms of analyzing, for instance, stability of functional networks, even at the individual level, and actually understanding what are the features that are shared across individualized functional networks, definitely we have to take into account this approach of going through a wide array of cognitive domains, but bearing in mind that there must be also some level of overlapping between them. Mm-hmm.
So then, okay, so I guess that's one strategy, right, is I've heard it described as the difference between deep phenotyping studies versus dense sampling studies, right? So clearly a variety of tasks that all measure, or many of them measure overlapping variants, and you can triangulate on actual latent features. But then the opposite of that is you do just the same thing for hours and hours, just a resting state scan, for example, or a certain task, and you get many, many minutes of data like that. Have any of you got a sense of maybe which of those, is one of them better in your opinion, or is there a one design fits all situation where one study design may be superior?
I guess I'll speak to that a little bit. I've become a big proponent in recent years of the so-called naturalistic tasks, like movies or audio stories. I think there are pros and cons to these states, just like there are any state. But I think the nice thing about them is they give you a lot of bang for your buck, right? I mean, in the sense that if we can't always collect, tens of hours of data on the same person doing a lot of different cognitive tasks, which I also think, to be clear, is a very valuable approach. But if we're trying to straddle that line of, we want to get enough people that we can look at some sort of trait level behavioral variables, but maybe we're also interested in within subject variables, I think the movies give us a really nice balance of driving the brain. First of all, I mean, they're just a powerful driver of the brain, right? Some of the work that I've been involved in, for example, with Tammy Vanderwall and some other colleagues, we were really interested in movies as a challenge to this idea of a QR code, right? Because there's seminal work by Uri Hassan and many other folks using movies in the scanner, but a lot of that work had been directed at showing how similar movies make people look to one another, right? So there's an incredible amount of synchronized activity that you can drive in the brain when you're exposing people to the same rich audiovisual stimulus that's, time-locked the same way in everybody. And that was, a very convincing result from this movie literature. And we had the thought, again, with Tammy and others, what do movies do to this individual connectome signal, right? And in many ways, it would have been easy to hypothesize a priori that maybe we break the QR code with movies, because if we're making everybody look quite similar to one another, is there still going to be that individualized variance that we can pick up on to do the fingerprinting? And we were sort of, I guess, pleasantly surprised in a way that even though movies do increase overall similarity across people, those features that allow us to identify people are preserved or perhaps even enhanced, depending on sort of the data set you're looking at and the metric that you're using, in the sense that movies equal or outperform, let's say, resting state or other traditional task states for things like fingerprinting, but also things like behavior prediction, right? And so at first it was sort of this paradox of, well, how can we possibly be improving the individual accuracy if we're also just sort of, making everybody look more similar? And I've sort of come around to view that not so much as a paradox anymore. I mean, I think we're sort of, with these naturalistic states, we're removing a lot of the, I won't say noise, but I will say interesting variants that we can't necessarily categorize within the same person across sessions, because resting state is a task, right? People are doing something, we just don't know exactly what they're doing. So with the movies, we're kind of driving a lot of that activity with an extrinsic stimulus, but there's still, we're sort of projecting people, I like to think of it, through this lens of the movie. And so we're reducing the overall amount of variability, but the variability that remains is more likely to be meaningful. We're more likely to be able to relate it to specific features of the stimulus, so we can model movies at many different scales. We can build simple models of sort of luminance or auditory information, but then we can build sort of mid-level semantic models and all the way up to high-level emotional features like the waxing and waning of the affect or various other sort of narrative arc-like properties. So to the extent that we are often limited in how much data we can acquire on a given individual, I like the idea of using movies as a way to sort of get these multiplexed signals at multiple places in the hierarchy, and the data can be modeled in a variety of really interesting ways.
I would just probably like to add that, so I completely agree with this idea of moving forward into naturalistic stimuli. I just would like to add, going back to your question, I don't think that there's really the best, the ultimate approach in terms of collecting data and in terms of how the data should be structured. It really depends on the research question. Ultimately, ideally, we would like to have like data sets that are either prominent in a subject dimension and as well as in a task dimension. This would be the perfect world. But of course, for many reasons, logistic reasons, we not always can do that. So we have always to target like a specific research question that it can be better answered with one of these, for instance, dimensions that are better covered in our data sets. So for individual differences, I think that overall, like data sets with a more prominent dimension on a subject level, we really can have like a very good description of how networks vary across at the population level, but we might want to answer questions about how certain networks actually evolve across time within the same individual. So what are the networks that remain more stable across time and the ones that does not remain as stable? And in this case, I would say that like deep behavioral phenotyping, like more data sets more prominent on a task dimension would answer this question better.
Okay. I mean, yeah. So the impression I get at the end of the day is it depends on your research question, right?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, that's a given. I have many more things that I want to ask you, but actually we've only got 15 minutes left. So I want to open it up to audience Q&A now. So if you, I'm going to have a look at the app. So you can submit questions on the app with the, well, you've seen it, you know how to do it. Or there's a microphone here. You can't shout out your question because it won't come up on the recording, but either you can come to the mic or if you wave your hand, Kevin can bring it to you because Kevin's helpful.
Just start it off. Hi, thank you very much. It's incredibly interesting, also the historical perspectives and also the data itself. So my question is, you're advocating the naturalistic as being more cognitively informative. So what are the differences actually so between the accuracy, because we are saying that this seminal work by Emily was showing that it's not fundamentally different. So maybe you can say something on that.
Yeah, sure. you know, I think one thing that I like to be careful about when talking about that 2015 paper is the accuracies were quite high, and that's been replicated by other groups and using even more sophisticated techniques than what we were using back then, in the sense that chance is also quite low. So chance, depending on exactly how you define it, in that original work was less than 1%. So we had 126 subjects. So if we were guessing by chance, we would be right one out of 126 times, right? So that's a pretty low bar. And the accuracies we were seeing in that original HCP paper were sort of, I think, between 55 to 95%. But that's also itself, there's a lot of variability in those ranges. And what that comes from is the particular pairings of tasks that we were using. So for example, if we're trying to identify people between two resting state scans, which is in theory the same brain state both times, but that was actually less accurate than identifying people between, say, you know, a complicated relational matching task and a motor, simple finger tapping motor task. So that was sort of our first clue that, you know, brain state does matter. And so, you know, we tried to be sort of careful with how we talked about and interpreted those results, because even though in one sense you can think about those results as turning the typical fMRI paradigm on its head, in the sense that, you know, I think for much of the early days of fMRI, we thought about our tasks as the primary manipulation, right? We are imposing a task on people, we're going to see changes in brain activity. Those changes are going to be at least somewhat consistent across people because that's how we do our statistics, so on and so forth. What we saw in the 2015 work and what other groups had seen before and after that too is a lot of the manipulation just comes from being who you are, right? And so we can impose tasks on that, and that does shift things around, but it doesn't make you necessarily look like somebody else. So, you know, Katarina Gratton had a nice paper sort of specifically quantifying the amount of variance associated with these sort of like shared group factors, individuals, tasks, and then interestingly, individual task interactions, right? So I guess the point that I'm trying to make is it's you can very much have sort of impressive accuracy with respect to chance level when you do these fingerprinting studies, but we also see a lot of variation around that high accuracy depending on the particular brain state in which we're acquiring this data. And so I guess, yeah, specifically with the movies, we were seeing, gosh, like I mean, all of the accuracies were high, but I think numerically, you know, we were seeing up to even 100% accuracy in that 2017 paper with Tammy Van Der Waal between even two different movie scans, and the rest to movie accuracies were kind of in the 60, 70% range. The piece that I'm actually even more interested in is the behavioral prediction piece. So we did another project using the movie watching data from the HCP project, which was a smaller data set, but we were sort of directly comparing behavioral predictions generated from movie watching connectomes to those generated from resting state connectomes. And there it was sort of interesting. So it depended on the particular movie clip and the particular movie content. But if I'm remembering correctly, I think we were getting correlations between predicted and observed behavioral scores around 0.4 was kind of the best we did with the movie clips, but the best we were doing with rest was more like 0.2 or something like that. So, you know, I mean, obviously the particular effect sizes are going to depend on the data set and the individuals and the behaviors that you're trying to predict and so on and so forth. I've sort of seen enough evidence that not only movies, but also even just these more traditional tasks are just giving us better individual signal. And again, we can talk about why that is. I think there's a variety of reasons for that, but just from this sort of practical standpoint of if we're trying to maximize this individual information, there's a lot of evidence out there now, I think, that resting state is not necessarily the optimal state in which to study people.
I guess I'm interested to discuss this a little bit because I certainly think it makes sense to do naturalistic stimuli in addition or depending on the research question. And in particular, going back to this idea about, I mean, from my point of view, thinking about how we're localizing function, or localizing cortical areas. I think that ability to do things like that is much less dependent on the task you're talking about. If we're saying this is, we're going to be able to get some sort of understanding of where things are all in the cortex, that is a different kind of question than, is the signal I'm seeing maybe a proxy for some sort of perceptual response that may make it more predictive for whatever reason. You know, if I am a high anxiety person and I watch an emotional thing that stresses me out, maybe I get a stronger signal than the next person who's less so. And so the bold is reflecting maybe a sort of proxy of that behavioral experience, which is why it might be more predictive of something like anxiety directly, which has less to do with how we're localizing functional organization or understanding how the brain is mapped. So that just is highlighting one way in which you could look at this or have a completely different goal in mind for what it is you're getting at. So just that makes...
Yeah,
okay. So I think there was one question here, and then I want to go to a question on the app. There's some good questions on the app.
This is all very interesting. And Tim, but other people too, you brought up motor quite a bit. And yeah. So it makes me wonder, you know, to what degree, you know, what is the spatial dimensionality of the individual finger tap? Because, and I think if you start from the center out in the brain, one would expect that the most homogeneous thing, at least in the cerebral cortex, would be primary motor, primary sensory motors is often lumped together, so around the central sulcus, and then diverging like more as you move anterior and posterior. So I'm wondering to the degree to which the individual fingerprint is, you know, one would, I imagine then maybe hypothesize that there would be less variability and less within primary sensory motor, and that the individual fingerprint would be more predictive, that you would get your QR code, so to speak, more based on what you were seeing in dorsolateral prefrontal, whatever, you know, other other more higher order regions. So I wonder if anybody, I mean, I sort of address it to you, but I really do am addressing it to everybody. So what people's thoughts on that?
Okay, I have a number of different thoughts on that. Yeah, so I think, yeah, so I mean, what we've seen is, I think has been mentioned, is certainly that what's interesting is actually within individuals, usually the largest variability is in primary motor and sensory regions. And I think that probably is most likely related to things like arousal effects, which are localized in those regions, in particular visual regions and motor regions and connectivity between them, at least when we're talking about functional connectivity. And so if you look at, I mean, the data just says, you know, session to session variability within a person is usually is loaded on that part of the brain, whereas cross-subject variability is loaded on those frontal and parietal systems. You bring up the motor strip, and obviously this is very recently just a super interesting topic for my collaborators in WashU, and that, you know, we have a really neat paper about the homunculus, and the point I would make there is that, you know, we might have expected that all of that, that the primary motor cortex would be just about simple things like motor, you know, finger tapping. But it seems that when we look in with these in more detail, there's connectivity within the motor cortex to higher order functional areas, which was somewhat unexpected and has changed certainly my view of how we define that linear pattern of the homunculus. So I have to plug that. I mean, Evan Gordon is the lead on that. I don't know if he's presenting at this conference, but definitely check that out. It's really cool. Yeah, so I could say that for the people who want to say more.
Yeah, I can probably add to that that it's true. Like, theoretically, you would expect that if you perform like a very constrained task, like finger tapping or like something very simple but very constrained, you say, okay, everybody's doing the same thing. We all have like higher increased shared variance. On the other hand, and I also found what Emily found in naturalistic task, I found it in MEG fingerprinting. You have sometimes in specific tasks, I don't know about the motor, I haven't tested the motor, but sometimes you have like higher similarity with the others because you are doing a naturalistic task or an auditory task. But at the same time, the individual differences are also enhanced, so that you get still a very high individual fingerprint in those tasks. And I kind of relate with the concept that Emily was making of you are putting them into a lens. You are not destroying individual differences, though. Like, they are constrained, but somehow the individual differences are still there. Sometimes they are even more enhanced. And I just want to give you this example with this paper that we did recently on MEG data. And we had this nice design where we had resting state, and then we have a transition. We had a transition of different auditory tasks. So the first one was listening to a prose; they were just listening to an audiobook. And then after that, they were different kinds of beep of different frequencies. So very simple auditory task. So you would expect, okay, if I just listen to a beep, nothing is going to happen, right? But okay. Be careful, because this is MEG data, so way more sensitive than fMRI. And what we found was the same thing that Emily found in her naturalistic scenario, where you have, like, you start with resting state, certain identification, identifiability, a certain fingerprint, and then as you go to the simple beeps, you would expect, okay, they are listening to the same beep, so the fingerprint is going to go down. Actually, it was the opposite. The fingerprint was enhanced, as well as the other similarity. Like, they were all more similar, but still, the fingerprint was enhanced. So the constrained nature, I still have to wrap my head around this concept, because it's dense of things, but it's kind of the constrained nature of the naturalistic task. Like, you're moving from an unconstrained state, like a resting state, to something precise, and yet there is you have this effect of individual difference. Yeah, please.
Sorry, do you want to just get the microphone before you ask that? Otherwise, it would be on the podcast.
Resting state involves the hardest motor task of them all. you know, as my yoga instructor liked to say at the end of, like, you know, Shavasana, right? It requires lying still, very still, not like an actual, like, taxing motor task, which is what's interesting, is like we all kind of tend to sometimes forget that. But anyway.
So I went off a tangent. I didn't really speak about the motor task. But you know, to follow your line of thinking, it would be interesting to see how sensitive, and I don't know if with fMRI data you can pick it up, because, you know, sometimes you need more sensitive measurements maybe to pick these individual differences up from this kind of systems. But it would be interesting to see in different kind of motor tasks, different level of constraints or different level of difficulties, what happens if you still get this enhancement together with the similarity, increased similarity.
Okay, I think we have to wrap up now. I want to ask like one final like closing question. Maybe actually it's from the app. Maybe it sort of wraps things up a little bit. But really, like 20 seconds or so each, maybe, if possible. Tim, you alluded earlier to this mythical average brain. The question on the app is, you know, how mythical is this? And actually, has anyone tried looking for what is the most average brain? Is that at all a goal that we could ever achieve, or is it really individual differences all the way?
Well, Emily mentioned Katarina's paper, which I think speaks to this kind of in a quantitative way, how much of functional connectivity structure can we explain as being common across people? How much can be explained as being specific to the individual? How much can be explained by being in a particular task context? And it attempts at least to try to quantify that to some extent. It's about a third is well described as a common property across individuals, and a third or more is related to differences between individuals, and then the task state and session-to-session variability is actually, I'd say more like 40-40-20, something like that. And I should know it off the top of my head, I guess. But look at the paper. So it speaks directly to how much of that is really, I mean, we can't, you know, I'm definitely going to push hard on let's study every individual as much as possible to get it right. But that's not to say that there is nothing similar about all. I mean, in most ways, we are very similar to each other. And actually, as an example of that, with the perinatal stroke case I brought up earlier, if you were to look at the functional networks on that person, basically, he looks like a group, like anybody else, but just missing that part. And it's kind of amazing, honestly, when you look at it, you can tell immediately, oh, that's the pattern. That's the topology I expect to see, even on somebody who's has a radically different brain structure. So we can't say that, you know, we're 100% unique in that program.
Does anyone disagree? We can talk about this for hours, right? I regret to cut it off, but yeah, we're at the time now. So I think we should, say thank you very much to all of our panelists who have given us some wonderful discussion today. Thank you very much.
NeuroSalience is brought to you by the Organization for Human Brain Mapping. This week's episode was produced by Alfie Wine, Farouk Golban, and Jeff Nash.